I'm very pleased to be here, to be back here. This is a place, as you well know, I've been here a number of times to the what was then the Civil Rights, Civil Rights Institute, now Carter G. Woodson Institute. And I feel like this is a place where much of my earlier work I have a strong connection, because some of the papers I presented here were kind of those ones where you're trying out ideas that might become books, and you get the feedback that says maybe this is not the right idea. So this has been a very useful place for me in terms of my academic development. And as all of you know, this is a major center. Over the years, many of the people who have influenced my own work and been part of that effort to write the history of our freedom struggle, much of that work has been done by either people here or people who visited here and gave talks. So it is good to be here, and particularly coming here from Atlanta. I was there at Ebenezer Church on Saturday, giving the King lecture there. And to have that opportunity to speak in the same church where Martin Luther King preached, although it was across the street then. Now they have a nice new building over there. And to be at the place, you know, when I'm talking about King and being within a number of yards of his birth home, Auburn Avenue. So how many of you have been there? A number of you. I think everyone should go and have that experience of understanding the place that produced Martin Luther King. It's a wonderful experience, because you begin to see how King was so grounded in a way that very few Americans are grounded. We're a very mobile society. And here is a person who was born in the home of his grandparents, who had moved there early in the 20th century. And down the street, he could go to his second home. That's what he called it, the Ebenezer Baptist Church, where not only his father preached, but his grandfather had preached there. And further on down the street, you know, at the end of his life, he's president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and that's on Auburn Avenue. And really, if you just keep walking, it's not very long before you get to Morehouse and Spelman, where Morehouse, where King and his father and his grandfather went to school, and Spelman, where the women in the family all had a connection with Spelman. And you understand that this is a person who was created out of a vibrant black community, that when I was in Atlanta, I saw members of the King family. So for over 100 years, they have been going to Ebenezer Baptist Church, at least some of them, and having that connection with the same place that A.D. Williams, King's grandfather, once preached. And you see that this strong community with strong institutions, and particularly a strong family, produced a person who had a message to the world, that someone who was created by this very specific black community environment became one of the most important global figures ever produced by this country. Now, I'm always, when I see Taylor Branch's wonderful three-volume work and that title that he, America in the King Years. Think of that, America in the King Years. If only John F. Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson had known that they were living in the King Years. And yet we know that that was right. that's king is the one who defined that time. They thought that they were in control of events. King was really the one who was helping to set the tone. And all of this is a way of introducing him as a figure for some who represented something so much larger than himself. He was a symbol for a larger movement. And this is what I brought to the study of King, because I didn't start out as a King scholar. Some of you know a little bit about my background, know that I was at the March on Washington. But I was one of those people who was there to listen to John Lewis, because he was the one who was my age and doing these wonderful things. He represented the student movement. I had met with Stokely Carmichael a few days before the march, and he had told me, why do you want to even go there? You know, why don't you join us in Albany or come down into Mississippi? And at that point, I thought the most exciting thing I could think of was going to the march. I mean, I was 19 years old. I'd never participated in a demonstration before. I didn't even tell my parents I was going to go, because this was my first great adventure as an adult. And it was because I knew that young people my own age, 19 years old at that time, were changing the world. And I never saw them as King's followers. And they never would have described themselves as King's followers. King was following them. That's the way they put it to me. Now, I hope he catches up with us someday. You know, these are, you know, whenever you see these phrases like King and his followers doing this and doing that, you know, when my daughter came home from high school and I wanted to look at her history book, and she was, you know, she didn't want me to look at it, but, you know, and because I wanted to find out what they were teaching her in high school. And they, you know, they were using these phrases like King and his followers did the sit-ins and the freedom rides. And I was saying, King didn't even go on the freedom ride. Yeah, they were trying to get him to go, but he wouldn't go because he was concerned about being arrested. Concerned that he was on probation. And they said, well, all of us are on probation. Why can't you go on the freedom ride? So from their perspective, there was a movement. It was a great movement. They admired Martin Luther King. We all did. And that was the reason why we stayed till the end of that long day of speeches. Because even if we were critical of Martin Luther King, Simon was too cautious. We all wanted to hear what he had to say. We all knew that he would give a wonderful speech. And that is something that led to a basic approach that I have in terms of understanding King. Of understanding that we wouldn't be here talking about Martin Luther King if not for Rosa Parks. If not for so many other people who made Martin Luther King possible. Think of that. Rosa Parks made Martin Luther King possible. Martin Luther King didn't make Rosa Parks possible. When she was sitting on that bus, her first thought wasn't to reach into her purse and get out her cell phone and call Martin Luther King and say, Martin, what should I do? She did what she had to do, and that opened up the possibility for Martin Luther King to show those qualities for which we remember him. She made him possible. So all of this is part of what I think we all need to bring to our understanding of Martin Luther King. That he was a symbol for this great social movement. What was that social movement about. We use terms loosely, and I've carried on this struggle throughout my scholarly career. I've said, I hate that term, civil rights movement. And of course, even in saying, I hate the term civil rights movement, I use the term because it's so ingrained into us that this was a movement about civil rights reform. And yet I understand how insufficient that term is. Was it really about civil rights reform? I think that Rosa Parks changed Martin Luther King's career. Because when I look at him, I look upon him as a social gospel minister who set out early in his life to talk about what is the gospel. And for him, the gospel was quite simple. It was the social gospel. It was the gospel that is conveyed in the Sermon on the Mount. And when he was a divinity student in his first year, he was asked to put down what was going to be his mission as a social gospel minister. And he said, my mission is to deal with unemployment, slums, and economic insecurity. Civil rights was not even on the list. That was Rosa Parks' contribution. He said, Martin, she basically gave him another job. So for 10 years, he became a civil rights leader. And from 1955 to 1965, with the passage of the Voting Rights Act, he performed that role reasonably well, I would say. He did a good job. And Lyndon Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act in August of 1965, and Martin Luther King is there, very proud of that achievement. And if he had simply been a civil rights leader, he would have announced at the end of that ceremony, I retire. I've done it. We've achieved civil rights reform, and I think we all need to pat ourselves on the back. I need to get a nice position at the University of Virginia and talk about what we did. Have a great nostalgia for all those great marches, Birmingham, all of that. And he could have well done that. And it would have been legitimate for him to take all the accolades for all of those wonderful things that were done during that 10-year stretch. But what did he do? He went to Chicago. He moved his family into a slum. He spent the summer of 66 in Chicago, living in the worst kind of housing. Of course, the slumlord came and found out that Martin Luther King was going to be moving in, went in and did a quick paint job to make it look halfway decent. But that's what Martin Luther King did. Do civil rights leaders move into Chicago slums? What are they trying to achieve? What is he doing in 1967? He's taking a stand on the Vietnam War. As many people asked at that time, what is a civil rights leader speaking out on the war in Vietnam? And how did he respond? He said, you haven't been listening to me. If you had been listening to what I've been saying, you would understand that this is not a civil rights leader speaking out of turn about foreign policy. This is a social gospel ministry preaching the word of God as I understand it. So you haven't been listening to me. And what is he doing in 1968? He's in Memphis, working with garbage workers. Think of that. 1948, he says, what is my mission? Unemployment, slums, economic insecurity. 1968, what is he doing? Poor People's Campaign, Memphis, garbage workers. He's back to his mission. That's the way I understand Martin Luther King. And he's also someone who has an understanding that our movement was not isolated in the world, that we were connected to the other movements that were going on. From the very beginning, when you listen closely to what he has to say, he's saying that we are connected to the anti-colonial struggles. We are connected to the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa. We are influenced by those struggles. Try to think of King in isolation from Gandhi, and you can't. He got his tactics from Gandhi. He understood that he was learning from another movement, just as that movement learned from our anti-slavery movement. So Gandhi learns from Thoreau. We learn from Gandhi. And people in South Africa learn from Martin Luther King. And these ideas go around in the world. And you have certain leaders who have the vision to understand that, you know, leaders such as W.E.B. Du Bois, who perhaps best understood the connections among these movements. So he saw that there was this great movement going on in the world. And this movement was connected to the great ideas coming out of the French Revolution and the American Revolution. So you have this confluence of these wonderful democratic ideals, the great democratic revolutions, expressed in our Declaration of Independence, ideas that influence movements around the world at the same time that Europe and America is imposing its control on the rest of the world. So at the high point of Western domination of the earth, when the vast majority of the population of the earth were oppressed peasants, just think in terms of the people in this room, how many generations are you removed from those peasants? Some of us, one generation, my case, in terms of my mother, was one of those peasants in the Deep South. Sometimes two generations, three generations. But that was the majority of humanity. People who had no rights. People who were illiterate. People who had no land. People who were slaves, serfs. People who worked for the master. People who were oppressed in ways that we cannot even imagine today. People who understood Christianity as a message of obeying one's master, because that's what they had been taught, and because they were illiterate, they were unable to understand it any different way. So they absorbed that message of their own inferiority. And yet, at that moment in human history, where Western domination was greatest, it was also a time of revolution among the people in the West. So they began to justify their revolution, as we in the United States justified our revolution on the grounds of all men are created equal. Not that Mr. Jefferson really believed that, but he said it, and he used it as a rationale for a revolution. So you have these ideas, these democratic ideas that are becoming popularized. At the same time, you have the oppressed of the world sensing that maybe their lives can be better. That they begin to get literate, begin to actually read the Bible. What a revolutionary act that was. The moment that a slave could read the Bible and begin to interpret that Bible differently from the slave master. That was why you begin to see the Great Awakening being part of this vast movement toward democracy and revolution in Asia, Africa, the United States. And you began to see people looking at the Sermon on the Mount and saying, that's not a metaphor. That's something I'm taking literally. Beginning to look at the Declaration of Independence and saying, that's not, you know, may have used those words quite loosely, but when Jefferson is saying all men are created equal and they get their rights from God, they understood that Jefferson didn't say all white men. He didn't say all U.S. citizens. He used a universal language that could be extended to the slaves and the oppressed of the world. And it was our older leaders, the generation of Frederick Douglass, speaking out and saying, oh, we need to take that seriously. And begin to realize those kinds of ideals. That's the tradition that Martin Luther King came out of. That's who influenced. When you look at Martin Luther King's oratory, it's not very original. He's borrowing ideas from the great oratory of the anti-slavery struggle. He's borrowing from Frederick Douglass. He's quoting from William Cullen Bryant and all of those wonderful 19th century orators. And that was part of what fed into the modern freedom struggle. So what King symbolizes, is a struggle that affected the majority of humanity. Just think of this room. In 1900, how many of you in this room would have been able to vote? Not very many. No woman in this audience would have been able to vote. And depending on how many generations from peasantry you are, not very many of the other people in this room would have been able to exercise the basic rights of citizenship. So how did this movement develop? You know, that to me is the great story of the 20th century. You know, I work in a history department and you know, it's not a bad history department. You know, it compares well with Virginia's. And it's, you know, there's a few Pulitzer Prize winners there. But yet, if I asked in my history department, what was the great story of the 20th century? People might throw out ideas, the Cold War, World War II, World War I, you know, all of these tremendously important events. But somehow, I don't think that anyone in my department would mention that the citizenship status of the majority of the population of the earth was changed during the 20th century. And that maybe that might be the important story. That maybe we might have a course on what we might call the greatest freedom struggle the world has ever seen. That happened in the 20th century. That every single person in this audience was fundamentally affected by that freedom struggle. Your life was shaped by that freedom struggle. And who were the great symbols of that struggle? Gandhi, King, maybe Nelson Mandela might be added to that list. Think of what that means in terms of a generation who lived through those struggles. You know, how much do we need in order to say that we've lived a good life? You know, we've achieved a lot. But there was a generation that said, we're going to fight against the Jim Crow system of oppression. We're going to fight against colonialism. We're going to fight against apartheid. And at the end of their life, they could say, there was once this Jim Crow system in the South. We overcame it. There was once this thing called colonialism that affected vast majority of people in Africa and Asia. We overcame it. There was this odd little thing going on in South Africa called apartheid. We overcame that too. That was just kind of a tap end of the 20th century, just say that we had overcome these three systems of oppression that had been around for a long, long time. That's a tremendous achievement. And yet, every one of those people I mentioned, Gandhi, King, Mandela, would have said at the end, that was not enough. That's not what we were trying to do. Yes, we achieved a great victory, and we should applaud ourselves, pat ourselves on the back, and all of that sort of stuff. But our goal was much more than that. And it's the much more than that that brings us to here. It's the much more than that. You know, when I've traveled a lot in India, and one of the things that was so clear in terms of studying Gandhi and his efforts is that he understood that being free of colonialism was not enough for India. And in fact, on the eve of India's independence, he expresses his disappointment in what India represents. And I think the same thing with King is that just as these victories over the Jim Crow system are taking place, King is saying, no, I'm trying to achieve something much more than that. And that's what he would be saying to us as an 82-year-old coming back for King holiday celebrations if they bothered to invite him to one. And sometimes I think that he would not get the invitation if they had a sense of what he would say. That these struggles, as important as they are, and I think that it is good when you're involved in the struggle for social justice, struggle to achieve these ideals that are laid out in documents like the Declaration of Independence. It is very important to take a moment and say, yeah, that was important. It's not every generation that gets to wipe out three major systems of oppression. We should pat ourselves on the back. We should recognize the heroic figures of that struggle. We should celebrate them and understand that that's not just King, that's all these people, nameless people who played important roles, the Ella Bakers, the Rosa Parks, the young people. We need to understand that when King achieves his great victory in Birmingham, it's not, King is in jail. He's writing a letter. And that letter was very important, but while he was in jail, young people, younger than the young people in this audience, teenagers, were making possible his greatest victory. Just as Nelson Mandela was in prison when the young kids in Soweto made it turn the tide of the South African struggle. So they need to be recognized. But I think that we need to begin to say, what are the remaining struggles? What was King struggling for in Memphis? What would he still be struggling for today? How much have we done to deal with the legacy of past oppression, the historical injustices that are rooted in those systems of oppression? What sorts of things are going to be the equivalent struggles of the 21st century? And I think we can see some of the things that King would be very concerned about. Have we eliminated slums, unemployment, economic insecurity? Has the world become more just in terms of the distribution of wealth and opportunity? What does it mean that a country that is based on the idea of opportunity is now facing the first generation that will have less opportunity than their parents? What does that mean for the ideals of America? What would King be saying about that? I think that those are the kinds of things that motivate me to try to understand King, not just as a person up on a pedestal who I admired as a 19-year-old, but rather as somebody who still has something very important to say to us today. Someone whose message is very relevant for our own times. Because after all, when King is quoting Jefferson, he's not talking about all U.S. citizens are endowed with certain inalienable rights. He's talking about all men. And King would, of course, say all men and women are endowed with certain inalienable rights. And those rights don't come from government. Those rights are inalienable. Those rights are given to us as birthrights by God. Governments can take rights away. Governments can protect them or not protect them. But those rights pre-exist government. Those rights are something that are part of the birthright of every human being, including people who are here illegally. What does it mean to say that every human being has certain inalienable rights? What that kind of gets us back to, do we take the Sermon on the Mount literally or metaphorically? If we take the founding document of this nation literally as opposed to metaphorically, we understand that we are a long way from realizing that ideal. And that's what King is always good about reminding us. So I want to end by, as I often do, I've learned that as much as I can express as Clay Carson, if I quote King, it comes across as much more profound. And one of the things that I think is often true is to take the familiar King, because most people who have heard the I Have a Dream speech have only heard the soundbite of it. They haven't read the rest of the speech, where it's really a speech aimed at Thomas Jefferson. It was mentioned that I helped design the King Memorial, and one of the basic ideas was that King was going to be facing in perpetuity Thomas Jefferson. That these two individuals, if you go to Washington, you'll see across the tidal basin, they will be engaged in a perpetual dialogue, saying, "What, TJ, what did you mean by those words?" And I hope that Americans can get involved in that dialogue. The same thing with his last speech. It's called the mountaintop speech. And what we usually get is the soundbite from the mountaintop speech. "I've been to the mountaintop and I've seen the promised land." It's a wonderful speech. I wasn't there for that one, but you know, it's a great speech. But listen to the whole speech. And in that speech, he was able to summarize his life, because he understood that his time on earth was limited. He said many times he wouldn't reach 40. He got to 39. So he understood that this was a difficult time to live in. And he might not have a long life, as he says. And it was at that point that he began to ask himself the question, if I had a choice of living at any point in human history, what would it be? And in that speech, he goes through the various periods of human history. You know, would I have lived during the Renaissance and during the classical time of Greece, and you know, all of these wonderful periods of human history that we read about in the history books. And he says, no, those would not be the time. That if God could grant me a wish of living at any point in human history, it would be right here in the middle of the 20th century. So he says, why? Why would that be so? And he said that it's very strange to want to live at a time when the world is all messed up. Why would I make this strange statement? I want to be living during this messed up period. The nation is sick. Trouble in the land, confusion all around. That's a strange statement. But I know somehow that only when it is dark enough can you see the stars. And I see God working in this period of the 20th century. Something is happening in our world. The masses of people are rising up, and wherever they are assembled today, whether they are in Johannesburg, South Africa, Nairobi, Kenya, Accra, Ghana, New York City, Atlanta, Georgia, Jackson, Mississippi, or Memphis, Tennessee, The cry is always the same. We want to be free. So I am happy to live in this period where we have been forced to the point where we are going to have to grapple with the problems that men have been grappling with throughout history. So I think that that's what I would bring to mind in terms of we're still living in this very significant period where the majority of the world's population are still discovering what democracy, equality, opportunity means, where they're still trying to find a new place for themselves in the world. And in doing that, what they're doing is they're inventing these ideals again. Because we've never really experienced democracy. If you think about the ideals that Thomas Jefferson was laying out, American equality and democracy and all those wonderful things, it was only in the 1960s that for the first time this nation approached, even experimented with being a democratic nation. Before that, it was demonstrably false. So that experiment with democracy, the American democratic experiment, is about 50 years old. We're a young democracy trying to be an egalitarian democracy with cultural diversity, racial diversity, and we don't know the outcome of that experiment. And that's our challenge. It's those of us in the room, and particularly those who don't have gray in their hair, who are going to determine the outcome of that experiment. And I think that's what, if Martin Luther King were 82 years old and here to tell us, that's our challenge for today. Thank you very much.
We do have some time for a few questions.